A comprehensive look at metformin use when other diseases are present alongside diabetes.
Using antipsychotic medications to treat delirium.
The sale of firearms without a background check.
And do you hear what I hear?
That was pretty good. That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on January 6th, 2017. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine, wishing all our listeners a Happy New Year.
And a musical one. It sounds to me like you're a tenor. I don't think I've ever made that observation in the past. And so since you started out with song, let us go directly then to a publication from the College of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery. What about earwax?
So Elizabeth, in 11 years of recording, we've never reported on earwax before. That's because there really hasn't been an update to the guidelines since 2008. There's been 3 new guidelines, 5 systematic reviews, and at least 6 randomized controlled trials that have been published since the initial guidelines in 2008.
All right, back to that sticky stuff, earwax. What about it? How could it be that compelling?
The reason for that is there are particular populations that are either at risk for developing impaction, and that is when the earwax either occludes or almost occludes the ear canal that can affect hearing and cause symptoms like fullness, infection, or actually vertigo. Populations that are particularly at risk are the older individuals, those that are cognitively impaired, young kids, and individuals wearing hearing aids.
Well, this is still a fairly limited population of people who may be potentially at risk, but there's a whole industry relative to the removal of earwax, which let's call it by its real name, cerumen. What about that?
Au contraire. About 1 in 10 kids has cerumen impaction, about 1 in 20 adults, and as many as 1/3 to up to 2/3 of those in nursing homes or those wearing hearing aids. So it can be a big problem. Okay, so let's go to the guidelines. First of all, primary prevention, recognizing individuals that are at risk that need to be screened. For those that have cerumen impaction, it needs to be diagnosed and treated, either by putting in something that will either soften or dissolve the earwax, irrigating it with water or saline, or removal. And depending upon which of those techniques will depend upon if there are modifying factors. Does someone, for example, take anticoagulants or blood thinners? In which case, you would not want to do something manual. You would use one of the medications. Conversely, if you have an ear infection or there's a perforated eardrum, you wouldn't use one of the medications that dissolves the earwax. 2 things I think that were important, one of which we knew, and that is putting cotton swabs in your ear. Not a good idea. It actually impacts it. But something I wasn't aware of is called ear canaling. Have you heard of that before?
I have heard of it. It's one of those sort of out there procedures that I kind of went woo-woo, but yes, I have heard of it.
Well, apparently there are tens of thousands of individuals that have used this alternative method. It's putting a hollow candle in your ear, you light the end outside, and that heat is allegedly supposed to draw out the earwax. Well, the studies here prove that that's not the case at all. So they recommend against what's called ear candling.
That's enough about that, and hopefully we won't be offering any more guidelines for a while. So speaking of guidelines, let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine. I said, gosh, metformin use in a comprehensive look at other comorbidities or other diseases people with diabetes may have.
And this is important because metformin is first-line therapy for people with type 2 diabetes. We know it's effective in lowering blood sugar, but more importantly, it's effective in reducing mortality. That's in people with type 2 diabetes, but many of these individuals have concurrent diseases, chronic kidney disease, congestive heart failure, or liver disease. Early on, these conditions were said to be a contraindication to the use of metformin. In many of these individuals, it would increase the level of metformin, that is, it wouldn't be excreted from the body, and the thought was that that would increase the complication rates. So what these authors did was they looked at the clinical outcomes from reported studies of the use of metformin in these patients that had diabetes and either chronic kidney disease, congestive heart failure, or chronic liver disease that was moderate or severe. And they looked at, does metformin increase or decrease mortality, and is it associated with more or less complications than other types of therapy? And what they discovered in looking at 17 observational studies was that the use of metformin is associated with an improved survival. Metformin decreased mortality by 22% compared to people treated with therapies other than metformin. Also, in those individuals that have congestive heart failure or chronic kidney disease, the use of metformin was associated with fewer heart failure readmissions. admissions. So this is good evidence that metformin use should be extended to these individuals with diabetes and either moderate or severe kidney, liver, or heart disease.
I think this is excellent news because, of course, we know that metformin is also one of the cheapest medications, and we know a lot about it.
Absolutely. And in fact, it doesn't cause weight gain. It's associated with less hypoglycemia than the other agents, and even in these patients as well. And it's first-line therapy. Extending this to the 20 or 30% of patients that have one of these conditions and in whom it was thought, well, maybe we shouldn't be using it, I think this data suggests we should be using it.
Since we're in Annals of Internal Medicine, let's turn to a very hot topic, which has also been appearing in the other medical journals this week. That's a look at firearms, in this case, firearm sales without background checks.
It's a study that was done to look at firearm acquisition without background checks. So if you poll Americans, and that's been done with regard to this particular topic, 90% favor universal background checks before firearms can be sold. What we want to know is the individual we're selling them to qualified, or more importantly, are they disqualified from being able to purchase a firearm? There are federal guidelines. So if you buy a firearm at a retail outlet, a federal background check has to be obtained before the person can purchase the firearm. However, many firearms are purchased personally. How often is that done so that a background check doesn't have to be performed? And in fact, if you look at 50 states, in 19 of them, even when it's sold personally, a background check is required. But in the other 31 states, it's not. So they examined 1,613 adult gun owners, and they were asked where and when they purchased their last firearm, and as a part of that acquisition, whether a background check needed to be performed. And what they discovered was that 22% of gun owners who reported obtaining their firearm in the last 2 years did so without a background check. That percentage was higher in states that didn't require it. If your state didn't require it, about 50% of them did not have a background check, as opposed to about 26% in states that did require it. As a population, if universal background checks are important to us, what this tells us is that a fourth of gun owners don't undergo one before they get their firearm.
Well, certainly concerning from a public health perspective. I would say, though, it's going to be really hard to get our arms around this in any meaningful way, since there are so many firearms that are out there and so many private sales that take place, even those over the internet, across state lines. I think we're going to be talking more about some of this data.
We have 33,000 deaths in the U.S. annually due to firearms, so we do have to get our arms around it. The data would suggest that in those 19 states in which it is required, that they're much better at getting a background check than the states that don't require it, so that there are some things we can do to help affect that somewhat. But I do think we need to get our arms around this.
Okay. Finally, then, let's turn to JAMA Internal Medicine. This recurrent topic of atypical antipsychotics and their usefulness, often used, of course, in people with dementia. In this case, in a palliative setting, do they really help?
With the newer atypical antipsychotics, there's been a tremendous use of the early and the newer agents in individuals that have delirium or agitation. We've talked before about how this is particularly relevant to individuals that have Alzheimer's that oftentimes present with delirium. Same thing is true with people undergoing palliative care for some terminal disease that oftentimes have delirium. As healthcare providers, or as caregivers for these individuals, we'd like to give them some treatment for the delirium. And the question is, do you improve their delirium? Are there side effects that we should be concerned about? To address this, the authors did a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial in 11 different Australian inpatient hospice or palliative care units in almost 250 participants, and they were randomized to either placebo or one of two atypical antipsychotics, risperidone or haloperidol. What they discovered is that compared to placebo, those that received the atypical antipsychotics, their delirium actually got worse. Furthermore, they were more likely to experience side effects, what are called extrapyramidal side effects, unusual movement disorders. And then most concerning is it also appeared to increase mortality. They seemed to die sooner receiving the antipsychotics. So although we'd like to think that we're actually making things better, this is a case where the treatment makes things more distressing, not less distressing.
And I think really valuable information because, gosh, there's so many challenges at the end of life, and I believe the last thing we want to do is complicate that.
Exactly. So we're better off identifying that delirium is present, seeing if there's some underlying mechanisms that we can prevent or modify, then using supportive care rather than the atypical antipsychotics. That was more effective and had less side effects than the medications.
On that note, then, of course, I'm going to do the earwax, and I'd like you to sing us out if you would this week. I guess you probably aren't going to do that. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well and listen well.